I'm Kimberly Atkins-Store, and this is On Point. Last night, the Select Committee to investigate the January 6th attack on the United States Capitol held a primetime hearing, the last one before it breaks for summer. They covered the 3 hours, or as the committee put it, 187 minutes, from when Donald Trump stepped off the stage at his Stop the Steal rally to when he posted a video on Twitter telling the rioters he loved them, but they needed to go home. The committee played an interview with Pat Cipollone, Mr. Trump's White House counsel at the time. Committee Vice Chair Republican Liz Cheney asked him if anyone in the White House wanted the rioters to stay in the Capitol.
I can't think of anybody, you know, on that day who didn't want people to get out of the Capitol once the, you know, particularly once the violence started. No.
What about the president?
Yeah.
She said the staff. So I answered.
No, I said in the White House.
Oh, I'm sorry. I apologize. I thought you said who else on the staff? I can't reveal communications, but obviously I think, you know, yeah.
That interview and other evidence shown last night hammered home one message. Donald Trump could have stopped the riot, but chose not to. Instead, he sat in the West Wing and watched the insurrection on TV. Even his advisors and friends and children begged him to stop. Jamie Raskin, a Democrat, is one of the 9 members of the House January 6th Committee, and he joins us now. Congressman, welcome to On Point.
Thank you so much for having me.
So the hearing last night focused squarely on what President Trump did and did not do as rioters stormed the Capitol. Your colleague, Congressman Adam Kinzinger, distinguished between a failure to act and a choice made by Donald Trump not to act. What's the importance of that distinction?
Well, you've got to see the president's failure to act or refusal to act over that 3 hours plus as part of a continuing course of conduct, right? He had convoked the mob, he assembled the mob, he incited the mob, he directed them at the Capitol, he knew that they were armed, and then he sat back like a guard at a bank watching the bank robbers go in and, you know, do their job. So what he was saying was, we're not arraigning him in a moral sense on just the obvious and outrageous dereliction of duty on that day. But that dereliction of duty was part of a pattern of his orchestrating this assault on democracy.
So Representative Kinzinger also said the committee would recommend legislative action to guard against another insurrection. What do you think that is needed? For example, as Vice Chair Cheney said at the end, intimating that nobody who violates their oath should hold office again. Does Congress need to pass a law that would prevent that?
Well, Congress may need to pass a law, but it would just be implementing a pre-existing constitutional command. Section 3 of the 14th Amendment says that nobody who has sworn an oath to uphold and defend the Constitution against enemies, foreign and domestic, anyone who violates that oath and participates in insurrection or rebellion should ever be able to hold office again at the federal or state level. The radical Republicans put that in the Constitution after the Civil War. It's not self-executing, which means Congress may, in this century, have to develop a machinery for making that constitutional command real. So that's one possibility. I think she was also sending a message to the Republican Party, to her party, saying that's something that should be internalized by Republican leaders. I think it was important for us to show Kevin McCarthy and Senator McConnell and others at the time absolutely deploring the events of January 6th, and Kevin McCarthy saying that these actions cannot be defended and no one should defend them. And then, you know, time passes and memories fade a bit, and then suddenly everybody participates in a kind of political conspiracy of silence around what had happened. And we're not going to allow that to happen because our democracy is just too precious.
So in making the point as to what the president was seeing in real time, the committee played clips from what Fox News was showing on January 6th. And the hearing itself last night was covered by every major news network except one, except Fox News. Are you concerned that your message is not being heard by a large part of the audience that needs to hear it the most?
I think that Donald Trump and his remaining followers are concerned that our message has actually penetrated the sound barrier. Something like 90 or 95% of Democrats are absolutely convinced of Donald Trump's culpability. I think more than two-thirds of independents, according to the polls I've seen, are convinced of it and believe the evidence that we've shown. And growing numbers of Republicans, somewhere in the neighborhood of 25, 30, 35%, understand that the big lie is a lie and that this was indeed an attempt by Donald Trump to overthrow the election. So I think the concerns are the other way. Otherwise, they'd be showing the hearings. But look, in a freedom-loving democratic society, you can't keep the truth away from people. And they would like to think that, you know, Donald Trump's followers, all, you know, tens of millions of them are in a religious cult and they can just be told to sleep on the floor and listen to their tapes. But, you know, everybody has families, everybody's got friends, everybody's talking about this, and people have access to the internet. And I think more and more of Trump's followers are going to start to defect from that cult.
So we did hear some evidence from some members of the vice president's security detail fearing for their own lives. Meanwhile, this week, the DHS Inspector General directed the Secret Service to halt its own internal probe of text messages that had been purged so that it does not, quote, interfere with an ongoing criminal investigation. The investigation into these missing text messages, it's extraordinary. But can you talk about what that means for the committee and its investigation?
Well, look, we've seen lots of different attempts to circumvent the authority of our committee. We have won pretty much every case in court against people in vain asserting an executive privilege or a former executive's privilege or whatever. We've seen other people kind of dodge and dance and try to hide beneath the covers. But overwhelmingly, people have cooperated with the committee. We've had more than 1,000 witnesses. And the truth is coming out. So people might think that they're clever in trying to hide evidence or conceal evidence or destroy evidence. And I don't know what happened with respect to all of these texts that mysteriously disappeared for January 5 and 6. But we will get to the bottom of it. I have no doubt about that. I'm really confident about it. And in any event, all of the basic elements of the story are absolutely clear to anybody who is willing to use, you know, a critical thinking mind.
Vice Chair Liz Cheney also indicated at a previous hearing that there was evidence of witness tampering. She said she turned it over to the Department of Justice. Has there been any more evidence that the former president or anyone else attempted to coerce or intimidate any January 6 witnesses?
Well, all the evidence we have from witnesses has been turned over, and we will continue to turn over that evidence. It's amazing to me that, you know, even with the whole world watching, that there would be attempts to interfere with witnesses. But that just reveals the desperation of the former president, who is kind of like the emperor with no clothes at this point. The whole world can see exactly what he tried to do with his multi-part effort to overthrow a presidential election, stage a coup against the Constitution and the people of the United States, and then incite a violent insurrection against the Capitol, our police force, the vice president, and the Congress. All of the truth will be known.
Okay, so your work is separate from what the DOJ is doing in its investigation. Earlier this week, Attorney General Merrick Garland said that it was one of the biggest investigations that the department has ever done. What do you want the DOJ to do?
Justice.
And what does that look like?
Well, you know, the Department of Justice is part of the executive branch, and traditionally, basically up until Donald Trump, there's been a basic respect for the independence of the law enforcement function. Richard Nixon got into similar problems with the was it a Friday night or Saturday night massacre? I don't remember which it was, but he tried to interfere with the operations of the Department of Justice to shield his own corruption and criminality. You know, Donald Trump got into the habit of trying to dictate to the Department of Justice who were they going to prosecute? Who are they not going to prosecute? He tried to usurp all of those. And, we saw the terrible results of that. So I try to demonstrate as much as possible my respect for the independence of the law enforcement function. I am not going to lecture them about how to do their job or what job to do. I'm happy to help explain to the public what the criteria are that they operate on. I mean, when they're looking at whether or not to bring a case, they look at the gravity of the offense. In this case, it's difficult to imagine a graver crime by a U.S. president than attempting to overthrow our constitutional order and install himself for another 4 years at least. We look at to what extent we need to deter this kind of misconduct, and that's obvious. We cannot be having coups and insurrections and political violence unleashed by presidents against our own system of government. And then we look at the culpability of the defendant, which again, to me, seems completely obvious. But what it seems like to me is really irrelevant because the Department of Justice, they have the greatest investigators and investigative resources in the world at their disposal. They've brought more than 850, it might be 900 cases so far against people who smashed our police officers in the face and broke our windows and interrupted the peaceful transfer of power for the first time in American history. They certainly have the resources at this point that we do, at the very least, to figure out how all of this came into being. Because I don't think there's anybody in the country who believes that any of this would have happened had Donald Trump not decided to lie about who won the election and pursue his absolutely madcap determination to stay in office, even when he had lost the election by more than 7 million votes across the country.
All right, Congressman Jamie Raskin, a member of the House of Representatives January 6th Committee, thank you so much for your time.
Thanks so much for having me.
I'm Kimberly Atkins-Store. This is On Point. Stay with us. After the break, we'll look further at last night's hearing and ask what we've learned.
Support for the On Point podcast comes from Indeed. If you need to hire, you need Indeed. Indeed is your matching and hiring platform that lets you find candidates fast. Ditch the busy work and use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. And listeners get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/onpoint. That's Indeed.com/onpoint. Terms and conditions apply. Need to hire? You need Indeed.
This is On Point. I'm Kimberly Atkins-Store, and today we're looking at last night's primetime hearing of the House of Representatives January 6th Committee. Joining me to sift through what we saw and heard are Rosalind Helderman, political enterprise and investigations reporter for The Washington Post. Welcome, Rosalind.
Thank you for having me.
And also joining us is On Point news analyst Jack Beatty. Hello, Jack.
Hello, Kimberly. Hello, Rosalind.
So, Rosalind, I'll start with you. Congressman Raskin said that what was presented last night was meant to be a part of an overall story about how Trump's inaction was part of a process that he used to try to subvert the results of the election. Do you think that the committee was successful in that endeavor?
I do think that they've been putting on a pretty compelling case through a combination of a well-structured narrative of facts we already knew, and also new testimony, new voices, new emails and text messages that show that at every point from November 2020 through January 6th, Donald Trump made choices. He had options of the path he could choose to take, and he chose to take a path that riled up his supporters, that inflamed tensions, that caused them to believe in lies, that it did those things even as violence was spreading around the country, and that made violence on January 6th certainly not a surprise and maybe even inevitable.
So, there was a point made that there was an inflection point when Donald Trump tweeted about Mike Pence on January 6th. And Donald Trump's deputy White House secretary told the committee that she was disgusted by Trump's tweet about Mike Pence because she knew his supporters listened to him.
He shouldn't have been doing that. He should have been telling these people to go home and to leave and to condemn the violence that we were seeing. And I'm someone who has worked with him. You know, I worked on the campaign, traveled all around the country, going to countless rallies with him. And I've seen the impact that his words have on his supporters. They truly latch on to every word and every tweet that he says. And so I think that in that moment, for him to tweet out the message about Mike Pence, it was him pouring gasoline on the fire and making it much worse.
So, Jack, what did you think about Matthew's comments about the hold Donald Trump has over his supporters?
Well, it's part of his, you know, what's been called his dangerous charisma. Former CIA profiler, said that he gives them permission to hate, and that's a very hard thing for people to give up. But you know, this Mike Pence and Donald Trump are today campaigning in Arizona for different candidates for Senate, I believe. And their relationship and Trump's targeting of Pence still, to me, is the most amazing and disturbing revelation from all of this. Carol Lenig, who, as you know, is an investigative reporter at The Washington Post, she was on PBS NewsHour last night. She said she interviewed Trump a couple of months after the January 6th insurrection and asked him, what did he hope to accomplish? And he said, I wanted what my supporters wanted. And she went on to say, well, what did they want? And she, quoting her, she said, to kill Mike Pence and to kidnap or kill Nancy Pelosi and to stop the peaceful transfer of power. Those words don't lose their power to shock. And nor does Trump's statement to, I guess, Mark Meadows, that the vice president deserved hanging. This Shakespeare couldn't come up with anything as poisonous as this. And nothing to me in all of this has been as shocking as that revelation. The putting the target on Pence's back and setting the mob after him.
And we heard from an anonymous security official who told the committee that Secret Service agents guarding Vice President Pence were fearing for their lives.
That last entry in this page is Service Capital does not sound good right now.
Correct.
What does that mean?
The members of the VPT tell at this time were starting to fear for their own lives. That there were calls to say goodbye to family members, so on and so forth. It was getting, for whatever the reason was on the ground, the VP detail thought that this was about to get very ugly.
And Rosalind, meanwhile, there was evidence last night that Donald Trump never did anything to summon law enforcement, National Guard, any help whatsoever. Talk a little bit about that.
During those 187 minutes when he refused to speak out, he was getting pleas from Republican members of Congress, from Fox News personalities with whom he was close, even from his own family members asking him to do something. And the committee played testimony from a variety of people who said not only did he not speak out publicly, not only did he walk the really matter of just a few feet from the dining room of off the Oval Office to the press briefing room to speak to the nation and to speak to the rioters directly, he also didn't call the National Guard. He didn't call the Department of Defense. He didn't call his Attorney General. He didn't call anyone in his role as Commander-in-Chief to try to stop this. In fact, the people he did want to call, he apparently asked in those hours for a list of Republican senators. He wanted to call them to keep urging them to delay the vote, to keep doing what he wanted in regards to the election. And another interesting piece of new information, at the end of the day, there was testimony last night that after all of the violence, after the day was finally calm again, as he was leaving for the residence, the topic on his mind was, as Jack was talking, the treachery of his vice president. He didn't talk about the violence. He didn't talk about the rioters. He talked about how he had been let down by Mike Pence.
And he also seemed upset that Mike Pence was seen as the person in charge that day when Mike Pence was trying to get additional response to the Capitol to help put the riot down. Right, Roslyn?
Yeah, there was testimony that Mark Meadows in particular wanted the word put out that Trump was in charge when he clearly was not, in fact, in charge. The military was listening to Vice President Pence, who does not actually have operational control over it. Mark Milley testified that when Meadows sort of started saying we need to put out that it's Trump who's doing these things, he was off put by that because he felt like that was a political consideration in a moment of actual security crisis.
And one piece of video that we saw was after Josh Hawley, the senator from Missouri, who earlier in the day had raised a fist to the crowd in solidarity. There was video of him fleeing afterwards. Jack, some folks have called that bit gratuitous. What do you think?
It certainly was a hit at him, seeing him scurrying across the hallway, and the gods of irony have arranged it. I mean, you couldn't. He is on apparently a crusade to, quote, revive strong and healthy manhood in America, and to buttress, quote, traditional masculine virtue. Whatever else we saw in that scurrying, it wasn't traditional masculine virtue. One can only hope that he will be haunted by that video throughout his political career.
And Rosalind, talk a little bit more about the people at the Capitol who were among Donald Trump's strongest supporters. At the time, in real time, not only wanting help to end the siege, but even in the immediate aftermath, really condemning what happened, and how some of them since have done a complete 180.
Yeah, you know, the committee, obviously their prime target in all of this is Donald Trump. But since the first hearing where Liz Cheney talked about how members of her party would be dishonored forever if they don't recognize the truth of what happened January 6th, they have also made these hearings an effort, Liz Cheney in particular, to send a message to the Republican Party about the ways in which the party has enabled Donald Trump and the ways in which she believes they should cease doing so. So there was a real effort last night to highlight the large numbers of Republicans who, in the immediate aftermath of January 6th, were willing to say that Donald Trump bore responsibility for this and have since stopped doing so. I think the most notable character in that script is Kevin McCarthy, the Republican leader in the House of Representatives, who, you know, was calling people, begging for help on January 6th, called Jared Kushner, begging for his help to get the president to speak out and send the rioters home, and then said publicly, actually both privately in recordings we have to fellow Republicans, members of the House, and then also publicly on the floor of the House, that Donald Trump bore responsibility for this. And then within days was down at Mar-a-Lago, or weeks, I should say, was down at Mar-a-Lago, sucking up to Donald Trump, and since then has become a major ally of his again.
So another feature last night was how some folks in President Trump's administration were resigning, leaving after the insurrection, some of his cabinet members, as well as some of his staff. Trump's deputy national security advisor, Matthew Pottinger, resigned immediately after the Pence tweet.
It looked like fuel being poured on the fire. So that was the moment that I decided that I was going to resign, that would be my last day at the White House. I simply didn't want to be associated with the events that were unfolding on the Capitol.
So, Jack, on the one hand, you had people who were resigning immediately, but then there was also testimony from other people, including former Labor Secretary Scalia and Cipollone, who said they didn't want the vacuum to be left if they were to leave, and they thought perhaps they could try to, I don't know, reduce the damage by staying. What did you think of that?
I think that was a defensible proposition, given how shaky and how out of control Trump seemed. And Scalia notably told the president, I think on the 2 days after the riot, perhaps the insurrection, he told him, look, you have to stop denying the election. You lost the election and you need to say that. That will begin the healing. Of course, Trump, to this day, there's no healing and there's no admission of the truth. So I think that was a defensible proposition. Not so defensible was the behavior of a White House aide who said to, I think, Sarah Matthews, when she was talking about resigning, he said, why give the media, this person said, why give the media that victory? That shows the Trump loyalist fan base mindset.
And Rosalind, did this is the last hearing before September, as far as we know, unless something changes. Did they end in a bang? I mean, we had this primetime lineup, and did they have to end in a bang? Do you think that it was enough to make the case that the committee's trying to make?
It's difficult to sort of critique their showmanship that way. They have done a really effective job of putting on compelling, watchable hearings. If you watch a lot of congressional hearings, they have departed from the way a hearing generally works. For one thing, they have dramatically reduced the amount of time you spend listening to members of Congress. So there's less grandstanding and there's a certain sort of narrative arc to each of these hearings. They've also done a really effective job of sort of telling a story, including some facts that may have been known to people who were following this, but also sort of seeding each hearing with kind of nuggets of new information so that there is a sense that they are unveiling new information. They did want to end with a bang. They had sort of Trump had been certainly the focus of all the previous hearings, but this was the hearing that was to focus most exclusively on Donald Trump and his actions, or I should say his inactions, his dereliction of duty. There was a lot of dramatic new testimony. I guess we'll see sort of in the ratings and the polls whether the public seems to agree that this was kind of the big bang conclusion.
And Rosalind, there was a lot of focus on this idea of dereliction of duty, that Donald Trump violated his oath. Why was the committee focusing on that?
I think that their goal was to sort of note that this was a national security crisis, and he was the commander in chief, and he had sworn an oath to protect the nation and the Constitution, and that he had a duty in this moment to act like the commander in chief and protect American democracy, protect the U.S. Capitol, and that he refused. He would not do those things. In fact, there is some evidence that they put on that he was gleeful at what the mob was doing. It was accomplishing the goal he had set out that day, which was to delay the certification of Joe Biden as his successor. They purposely chose two members of the committee, Adam Kinzinger and Elaine Loria, to lead the questioning last night because they are both military veterans. They wanted to use those biographical details to highlight, that people who have sworn an oath have certain duties to the Constitution and that Donald Trump failed in those duties.
And Jack, what stood out to you the most about that focus on dereliction of duty?
Just that, the contrast between those two members of the committee and their military service and Mr. Trump, and the contrast with Mr. Pottinger, who was an ex-Marine, who said he called up his boss, Robert O'Brien, he said, I'm resigning. after Trump had affixed the target to with his tweet to Mike Pence's back. He said, I'm resigning. And the security advisor was away from Washington. He said, would you stay on the job, please, until I come back? And he said, yes, I would. That's my duty to stay here because foreign, you know, America's enemies don't stop just because we're in the middle of a crisis. So he stayed by his post doing his duty.
And Jack, I know I don't want to get too much into the showmanship aspect of it, but, you know, after, especially after the really groundbreaking hearing before that, that really seemed to shake Washington. Do you think last night was enough to keep America's attention?
Well, it will keep the attention of the political class and of Democrats. Apparently, nearly, what did we hear from Representative Raskin, 90-odd percent of them are, you know, are at least aware or watching and believing Trump culpable. Beyond that, I don't know. I thought there was a pretty strong hint, oh, well, a weak hint, but a gravid hint from Liz Cheney last night about what's to come. She said, doors have opened. New subpoenas have been issued, and the dam has begun to break.
All right, I'm going to ask Rosalind and Jack to stay with us. When we come back, we'll take a look at some other evidence of the connections between Donald Trump and the January 6th attack. I'm Kimberly Atkins-Store. This is On Point.
Did you kill Marlene Johnson?
I think you're one of the first people to have actually asked.
From WBUR and ZSP Media, this is Beyond All Repair, a new podcast about an unsolved murder that will leave you questioning everything.
Somebody should be in jail for murdering my sister.
A woman who's never been believed.
As long as they think I have done this, then they're not looking for who actually did this.
And that's what makes it a cold case.
No, it's a botched case.
And a search for the truth, once and for all.
Wow, it just gets more interesting.
Beyond All Repair. Listen and follow wherever you get your podcasts.
Be careful. You're digging in a place that's been very peaceful for a while.
Do it anyway. Dig.
This is On Point. I'm Kimberly Atkins-Store. Next week, we're going to take a look in the mirror and talk about what is wrong with the news. Amanda Ripley, in her recent op-ed in the Washington Post, stated a startling fact that 40% of Americans actively avoid the news. So what are we doing wrong that makes so many people avoid our product? Information about the world we all share as humans? Are you a journalist who, like Amanda, has stopped reading and watching the news yourself? Are you an avid news consumer who feels helpless to solve the problems facing us? Tell us your story at 617-353-0683. That's 617-353-0683. Today, we're looking at last night's primetime hearing of the House of Representatives January 6th committee, and I'm here with On Point News analyst Jack Beatty and Rosalind Helderman, an investigative reporter with the Washington Post Democracy team. So before I get back into what the committee was focused on last night and what the witnesses said, I want to stop for a minute and talk about the Department of Justice. On Wednesday, we saw Attorney General Merrick Garland at a press conference, probably as animated as Merrick Garland can get, really pushing back on the increased criticism about the slow movement of the DOJ, stressing that no one, not even the former president, is above the law. And he said, quote, we have to hold accountable every person who is criminally responsible for trying to overturn a legitimate election, and we must do it in a way filled with integrity and professionalism. So, Rosalind, what did you think about the attorney general's comments, and how does that dovetail with what the committee is doing?
Yeah, I mean, we know that the Justice Department and the committee have different responsibilities and different focuses. I know Congressman Raskin was speaking to this earlier in the program. The committee is laying out a case, a moral case, really, for the country. And also, we are told, is going to make recommendations for possible legal changes as a result of all this. It is the Justice Department that is responsible for conducting criminal investigations and ultimately making decisions about whether or not a person should be criminally charged. We do know that there is an investigation underway. There was just a couple weeks ago a pretty dramatic sweep of subpoenas and search warrants issued to people around the country, people who served as the so-called Trump fake electors, as well as people who organized that strategy, Jeffrey Clark, the Justice Department official. Justice Department investigations are supposed to be confidential. My guess would be that they are doing additional investigative techniques that are not yet public and we don't know are going on. And we also know Justice Department investigations tend to move very slowly. My own view is let's give it a little time and see what they come up with.
And Jack, Rosalind's absolutely right. The DOJ and Congress, the committee, have completely different jobs. But is it possible for the moral case that the committee is trying to make to hold without accountability, which would come from the DOJ?
It would seem like it was a wind-up without the pitch, that finally there was no consequence. And, of course, the message that would send to Trump, to the future, that a president is immune to prosecution even after he's left the office, that would be disastrous. You know, Donald Trump has really benefited from morally chaste lawmen like James Comey and Robert Mueller. He has had break after break from such people. And as I look at Mr. Garland, I see the signs of that. That I won't call it morally preening, but he is a very righteous man. And I rather wish that, who knows what's going to happen, but, you know, the other candidate for his job was Doug Jones, the former senator from Alabama, who prosecuted the Birmingham bombers, the men that killed the girls in that church in Birmingham two generations ago. He's a man with some real substance and guts. And I just hope that that Mr. Garland can find within himself the resources to address the problem seriously. You know, people say he should think of healing the country. Jack Goldsmith, the prestigious lawyer, has said that. That needs to be one of the things he thinks about. And yet people argue today, two law professors in the New York Review of Books argue, no, that's not the job of an attorney general. That's a political question. His job is, does what the president did, how does that stack against the law and the facts? And if they say he committed offenses and that they're prosecutable and there's a probability of winning, they must go ahead and leave questions of, you know, will this tear apart the country? Will this? Those are political questions, not legal ones. Mm-hmm.
And while we're on the topic of the DOJ, one of our listeners, Renee Shapiro, wrote on Facebook, is there any chance of going beyond prosecuting Trump to hold Hawley and other congressional supporters of the insurrection accountable? Roslyn, what do we know about where the DOJ is looking in terms of potential criminal liability?
I am not aware of any evidence that we have seen so far that DOJ.
I think we just lost Rosalind Helderman. We'll work on getting her back. But Jack, let's go to you. What do you want the DOJ to be doing?
Well, I mean, going after members of Congress, but if the committee issues a report that, you know, targets members of Congress, it'll be hard for the Justice Department takes that, it'd be hard for them not to at least consider it seriously. But that gets into the question of, you know, what will the Republicans do to the Democrats once they take over the House, as it seems almost likely. So I can imagine that the committee is going to avoid that kind of thing, just simply not to so as to minimize the danger that we're going to see, you know, purges and you know, hearings about the members of this committee and efforts to, you know, to tarnish them. It could set off a spiral.
Republican committee member Adam Kinzinger said the committee isn't just looking to show what happened and punish those responsible, but also put forward laws so this can never happen again.
When we present our full findings, we will recommend changes to laws and policies to guard against another January 6th. The reason that's imperative is that the forces Donald Trump ignited that day have not gone away. The militant, intolerant ideologies, the militias, the alienation and the disaffection, the weird fantasies and disinformation, they're all still out there, ready to go. That's the elephant in the room. But if January 6th has reminded us of anything, I pray it has reminded us of this. Laws are just words on paper.
So we have Rosalind Helderman back. Rosalind, we heard earlier from Congressman Raskin saying that one of the things that could come of this is some sort of executing, self-executing law that prevents people who have engaged in an insurrection from holding office again. But what else do you think this committee might do legislatively as a result of the evidence they've put forward?
Yeah, first off, I thought that was a really interesting idea that the congressman raised. I'm going to be watching that one very closely. We have seen some other efforts to try to bar folks from running for office who were involved that day. They have not been very successful thus far. So that was really interesting. I think there's going to be a big look in Congress at the Electoral Count Act, the law that governs how that certification process is completed by Congress, to try to find ways to, for one thing, clarify the role of the vice president as the president of the Senate in that process, to make it clear that that role does not give the vice president the power essentially to decide the victor of the election. There may be other provisions of that law, including the way in which disputes are settled, the way in which the current law says that under certain conditions, the outcome of the election would be decided by the House voting as delegations rather than as individuals. So I think that's going to be a big one, and expect to hear a lot about that on Capitol Hill in coming weeks.
So a big portion of last night's hearing focused on Donald Trump's inaction, even his lack of desire to condemn the insurrection in real time, but also after the fact. The committee played outtakes of President Trump's address the next day, where he showed even then he wouldn't concede.
You do not represent our movement. You do not represent our country. And if you broke the law, you can't say that. I already said you will pay. The demonstrators who infiltrated the Capitol have defied the seat of dust. It's defiled, right? See, I can't see it very well. Okay, I'll do this. I'm going to do this. Let's go. But this election is now over. Congress has certified the results. I don't want to say the election's over.
I don't want to say the election is over, Jack. What do you think the committee wanted to convey with that never-before-seen outtake of the president's video?
Well, he's he still hasn't said it, and just this week we learned he was calling the Speaker of the House in Wisconsin and saying, "Would you help me overturn the results in Wisconsin?" Caitlin Collins of CNN reports that it took him an hour. It was so painful. It took him an hour to record that 3-minute video where he tellingly said he couldn't bring himself to say the word yesterday. And of course, he's haunted. We all are by yesterday, January 6th.
And Rosalind, we were talking before about some potential legislative recommendations, but if this committee's work goes into the fall, will there even be enough time to even try to pass laws that can guard against the next insurrection before the midterms?
Yeah, that's a great question. We know that the committee is very cognizant of the ticking clock That's one reason why they had said previously that this was going to be sort of their time for hearings. And then they had anticipated doing one more in September to release a report. Now they are extending their timeline. It seems as though they've become aware that, you know, even if Democrats lose the House, they keep it until January. And so they're viewing sort of the deadline for their action as January as opposed to November. But to get something done in Congress is going to require bipartisan action. It does seem as though there is some bipartisan interest in a reform of the Electoral Count Act. But you never go wrong by assuming that Congress is too gridlocked to get something done in a short period of time. So we'll have to see how that plays out.
And Rosalind, what do you think will be coming up in September? I know the committee's work is ongoing and they can uncover any number of things throughout the month of August. They seem to indicate that they would continue their investigations. But what do you think we will learn in September? Do you think it'll be more about this disappearing Secret Service text? Or do you think there's still a hole in the case that they've made so far that they need to fill?
I think our understanding is they have not yet entirely decided what they wish to devote the September hearings to. They have some areas of interest. I think they're interested in talking more about the roles of Mike Flynn and Steve Bannon and Roger Stone. They're interested in the fundraising that was going on from Republican groups and Republican allied groups, how much money was being raised off the back of the Stop the Steal myth. Including run by people who said privately they understood that it wasn't true. But I also think they've been very clear that the hearings themselves created the conditions to collect new evidence. And it may well be that we hear in September things that the committee is only just now receiving or will receive and analyze in coming weeks. So we'll have to see.
Do you think that there's a possibility that we will hear from Mike Pence?
A good question. We haven't heard any new reports of new negotiations. Mike Pence had been uninterested in participating in this process, and I haven't seen any signs that the hearings have moved him from that position. But, you know, hope springs eternal, I'm sure, on behalf of the committee.
Jack, what are you still hoping to hear from this committee in September?
I don't know. I don't know what's certainly there are hints, but you know, September may bring a big announcement. Donald Trump may announce then or before the election that he's going to be a candidate in 2024. He told New York Magazine it's a question of when, not if. And one of his motives is that he thinks that if he's a candidate, that will shield him from prosecution, that Garland would never dare go after an active presidential candidate with a criminal indictment. Is he right about that? And he feels that that's his protection. That's really going to test the Justice Department, and that's going to be coming up pretty soon.
And Rosalind, Jack is talking about how an announcement of a re-election campaign by Trump might or how he might think it would impact the Department of Justice. But how do you think that announcement would affect the committee?
Yeah, it's an interesting question. I mean, by September, I think we'll be past the Liz Cheney primary. So we will know whether she has, in fact, lost her her campaign to be renominated as a Republican congresswoman. You know, I think given the posture they've adopted so far, it would tend to merely sort of harden their desire to show the country what they think Donald Trump is. Before he really gets in a mode of potentially being elected president again. But, you know, the politics of that are a little difficult to predict how it affects the committee members at that time.
All right. Rosalind Helderman is a political enterprise and investigations reporter for The Washington Post. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
And On Point's news analyst, Jack Beattie. Thanks as always, Jack.
Thank you, Kimberly.
I'm Kimberly Atkins-Store. This is On Point.